Good morning. The House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance will come to order. The committee legislative assistant will call the roll.
Chairman Smith is excused. Vice Chair Schmansky.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Anderson.
Here.
Representative Champion. Representative Cornish. Representative Grunhagen.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Kreisel. Representative Lane is excused. Representative Lesh. Representative Liebling.
Here.
Representative Mazarel.
Here.
Representative Maleen.
Here.
Representative Schumacher.
Here.
Representative Vogel.
Here.
Representative Wardlow.
Here.
The chair notes quorum is present. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of the previous meeting of the House Judiciary and Finance Committee?
Mr. Chair, I move approval.
Representative Mazarel moves the minutes of the previous meeting. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carried. I'd like to remind everyone, the members of the committee and our guests today, that if we do not complete our schedule this morning, we will recess at 10 a.m. and reconvene at the call of the chair approximately 4:30 this afternoon. Our first bill on the agenda is House File 795, bringing the bill before the committee. The chair would now like to bring Representative Hoppe with House File 795 before the committee. Do I have a motion to move House File 795?
So moved.
Representative Grunhagen moves House File 75 to be recommended to pass and place on the general register. The chair now recognizes Representative Hoppe to explain House File 795.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Grunhagen and members. House File 795 is a fairly simple, straightforward bill. We are looking to have the state of Minnesota enter into a reciprocity agreement with the nation of Bermuda, dealing with matters of child support enforcement. We heard the bill in civil law. I'm not aware of anyone. No one testified against it. I'm not aware of anyone that's going to testify against it today. And I have Heidi Shea, who is a constituent of mine and who is the person most interested in this bill passing, that will speak briefly and give you some background on why we're here.
Thank you, Representative Hoppe. Ms. Shea, please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Heidi Shea, and I'm the mother of two wonderful children that are not being financially supported by their father, who lives in Bermuda. I've been trying to get legal and government support for 7 years, but received no help because no one knew how to handle an international child support case without reciprocity already in place. There are currently 9 states with reciprocal agreements. My divorce was granted in 2005, and my ex-husband paid child support for a short while and then stopped when he realized I couldn't enforce the order in Bermuda due to the lack of a reciprocal agreement. In addition, Hennepin County Child Support Services would not initially open my case because the state of Minnesota does not have reciprocity. Hennepin County Child Support Services had to be ordered by a judge to take my case and open an account, which they did, but only acting in an account monitoring capacity. So it's been a really frustrating journey for me trying to support our children. My former spouse owns a successful contracting business with hard assets, and he's entirely capable of paying child support. He simply relies on the fact that the state of Minnesota doesn't have jurisdiction over him without reciprocity while he resides in Bermuda. According to Bermuda laws on child support maintenance, a registered order made by courts in reciprocating countries may be enforced in Bermuda as if it had been made by the registering court and as if that court had had jurisdiction to make it, and proceedings for or with respect to the enforcement of any such order may be taken accordingly. I need child support reciprocity agreements in place. I ask the state of Minnesota to draft legislation to enter into a reciprocal agreement with Bermuda. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shea. Are there any questions among the committee members? Seeing none, are there any other people in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, There being no further witnesses, public testimony is now closed. Is there any other discussion on House File 795? Hearing no further discussion, Representative Grunhagen renews his motion that House File 795 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail, and House File 795 is recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The Chair would now like to bring House File 1124 by Representative Anderson be before the committee with the intention to lay the bill over. Do I have a motion to move House File 11? The Chair will move House File 1124 to be considered to pass and placed on the General Register. Good morning and welcome, Representative Anderson. I understand you have an author's amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do. House File 1124.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. The Chair will move House the A1 amendment to House File 1124. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. The Chair now recognizes Representative Anderson to explain House File 1124 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Minnesota Statutes 364 applies to the rehabilitation of criminal offenders, and this bill will allow, as an alternative to the listed evidence of rehabilitation, the person's honorable discharge from the military, provided that the discharge was obtained subsequent to the conviction. And I have with me two gentlemen that would like to testify on behalf of the bill, if they could be recognized and allow them to testify.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is John Baker. I'm a retired gunnery sergeant in the United States Marine Corps. I spent 22 years in the Marine Corps, retired and became a lawyer. After that, I'm now a partner in the Baker Williams Law Firm. I had asked Representative Anderson to introduce this bill. And the main reason for this, Mr. Chair, is we're experiencing the Federal Department of Labor just in January came out with their latest labor statistics and said that there is a 15.2% unemployment rate amongst our returning combat veterans, or returning Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. In my opinion, we have this next greatest generation of veterans coming back from these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. You have a representative amongst your committee here that represents that group, and I honor that Representative Kreisel today for his service. This next greatest generation, as I call it, coming back from these wars, I think they ought to be the next generation of business and community leaders. And I think it's up to us as leaders in the community right now to help break down those barriers for those veterans coming back home. This bill is simply one of those. I'm part of the Military Action Group working with former Representative Severson. We've been, over the last couple of years, systematically breaking down these barriers. A couple of years ago, we asked to get veterans' preference applicable to state agencies. We got a microloan for veterans starting businesses last year. This is just one of the examples that we want to do this year. The Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, one of the preeminent veteran organizations for the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, their legislative agenda for this year, their number one priority is unemployment amongst veterans. It's becoming a national issue and a national crisis. I think the veterans that are coming back, that have fought for our country, coming back, seeing double the unemployment rate that the national unemployment rate, and we're seeing a decrease in that unemployment rate, I think it's remarkable. So I think we need to break down these barriers. So what this bill does, this adds to Chapter 364, which is the state of Minnesota has recognized that since 1974 that criminals ought to be able to rehabilitate themselves. So conceivably today, you could join the military and have a criminal record. Whatever kind of criminal record that could be, you could join the military, conceivably could serve 4 years in the military, see combat, and become honorably discharged and come back home to Minnesota, and guess what? You still have difficulty getting a job. You still have difficulty renting an apartment or getting a state license. What Chapter 364, what this bill does is it adds a honorable discharge certificate to competent evidence of rehabilitation for somebody that's coming back from these wars. And what that will allow, it doesn't guarantee a veteran a job. What this does is it's competent evidence to show that this individual who's honorably served ought to be able to get a license. It exempts law licenses, by the way. That's dealt with in a different fashion. And it exempts police officers as well. But for any other type of license, if you want to get a real estate license, if you want to get a chiropractor license, if you want to get a license to be a some kind of a tradesman, this is allows a veteran to be able to get just a little extra help for a veteran to be able to get one of these licenses. That's all the testimony I have, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. And will the next testifier please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, and fellow veterans. My name is Hector Mattis Castillo. I am a veteran, 18 years, former First Sergeant, United States Army, and former Special Operations Ranger, 1st to 75th Ranger Regiment. If you wouldn't have ever known me before, you would have never known that I was once committed of a crime. I had, in January 2004, stood in front of eight police officers in Lakeville in a standoff due to post-traumatic stress disorder and being in a dissociative state. If you ever heard me speak, you'd know that, but if you haven't, you'd know that I'm just another veteran that's out there doing social work right now. It took a year before I actually got convicted. In January 2005, I was convicted of a gross misdemeanor. It could have been a felony, and it probably should have been in the eyes of many, but I was spared. I was shown mercy and grace in the courts. I was shown the ability to be reconciled and restored, but that's the one piece that was missing. So when I walked out of that court, allowed to continue to serve with military involvement, serving the JAG, Judge Advocate General was present throughout all my hearings to make sure that I was allowed to continue to serve. What I didn't know is that my job was gone for sure. I wasn't going to be able to get back to work, and life was going to be actually tougher. There were times when I actually said, man, a felony would have just been easier. But I was glad, I was happy that I was shown grace and mercy. See, what happened was, for a year after that, I kept looking for work. I was denied employment everywhere, to include being PCA to my own son. I wasn't allowed to take care of my own son living in my house. So finally, what I decided to do was I accepted a deployment. So although I continued to slowly decelerate in the civilian career, I continued to accelerate in the military career. I was a staff sergeant at the time, which is an E6. I was promoted two times to E8. It's the second highest pay grade in civilian grades, in enlisted grades for the military. I led a unit of 167 Minnesota infantrymen into the Al-Anbar province during the surge in Iraq, and I brought them all back. I received the Bronze Star and numerous other awards for my combat experiences and for my leadership. And when I came back, it was back to the same situation. No employment because of a previous criminal conviction. Although I had an honorable discharge, although I had an impeccable service record, 18 years of impeccable military history and service, 13 combat deployments later, 57 different countries later, and up to 12 languages barely spoken later, I was still unable to get work. I had a bachelor's degree, and I was working towards a master's degree. It wasn't until 2010 that I was actually offered employment, and it was through the Board of Social Work that I became a social worker, and I am now a practicing psychotherapist. But ladies and gentlemen, it took 6 years to get to that point, and I'm an outlier in that I didn't give up during that time. There are a lot of other veterans that do give up when the leg of employment is taken out from underneath them. So I ask you to consider this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank
members
you,
of the committee.
Mr. Castillo. Any questions? Don't see any. All right. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay, there being no further witnesses, public testimony is now closed. Any further discussion amongst the committee on House File 1124? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you for your service, and you know, I think this is a very important thing to do. Yeah. I do worry a little bit that you know, one of the things I think might be that even if we presume that somebody's rehabilitated, you know, with the internet now, it's still possible for employers to find all kinds of stuff. So, you know, even when a court expunges a conviction, it doesn't really go away, and that's still a concern. But I just wanted to speak up and thank you for coming today, and thank you for your service to our country.
All right, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To testify again, thank you for your service. A question I have with regard to rehabilitation: if a person went in with a chemical dependency problem or an underlying mental health issue and it was exacerbated during his service, how would that play with respect to evidence of rehabilitation? Do you think that would create a problem with respect to that, to his service then evidencing rehabilitation, if in fact because of the stresses he underwent or the underlying mental health or chemical dependency issues he experienced? Any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. First of all, an individual coming in with a diagnosis, I am a psychotherapist now, by the way. Mm-hmm. An individual coming in with a diagnosis into the military would be looked at very, well, under a great scrutiny. So there's no telling whether or not an individual will be allowed in. Of course, a lot of people we know have trauma before they join, and then they come in, and it goes undetected, and it may be impacted by military service, and it may not be impacted by military service. So to answer your question, I would say that it's very difficult to know how to answer that question, being that it's very difficult to be able to spot these individuals to begin with. It could be said that all of us have had trauma to a certain degree, and all of us still have the right to stand up and take the oath to serve our country, and I guess test our mettle that way. But it's very difficult to answer that question, knowing that it's very difficult to spot the diagnosis without a previous history of trauma diagnosis. So.
Representative Johnson.
Well, I think employment is one of the best forms of rehabilitation, so I do appreciate you bringing this bill forward.
Mr. Chair, if I can add something, Representative Johnson, I would like to point out within this bill there is, and that was part of what the amendment was today, the DD-214, the honorable discharge, ceases to be competent evidence with a subsequent charge, and the County Attorney's Association had asked that amendment it be brought down to a gross misdemeanor, which I don't see any problem with. So a gross misdemeanor charge after an honorable discharge then ceases to become competent evidence. So I think that gets to your issue is, you know, we have veterans that are coming back, a small minority of them that I'd like to point out that are having difficulty, that have PTSD, that are having contact with the criminal justice system. And that, by the way, is one of the reasons I chaired the initiative last year to start the first veteran court here in Minnesota. We have that up and running. It's been running since last July in Hennepin County. It's one of the reasons we have that initiative to address those issues. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. And Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Matus-Castillo, I say your name a lot, and I'm sorry for butchering it. Mr. Matus-Castillo, thank you. Thank you also for the things you've done. You and I have had conversations, and I know I have a lot to learn from you in the future here based on my path. My question for you is, what kind of help did you get? I know things have changed a lot in the Army over the course of the last 7 years. But after the 2004 incident, what kind of help did you get from the Army to help you put in a better position, to put you in a better position, whether it was for employment or generally in your life?
Mr. Matus-Castillo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh. Initially, at the time that the incident happened, sir, I received very little help. There was few individuals that would actually stand by my side, but those individuals are champions and helped make change in the military, which now has led to a lot of different things that commanders can do and first sergeants can do. One of the things that finally did happen, one of the champions was a very prominent leader in the military, and that individual put me on orders to be able to get the TRICARE benefits, in other words, get insurance, in order to be able to go to a therapist while I was able to get into the VA, to get supervision, to be able to get me sort of in a, taken care of in a wraparound type of fashion. But at the very beginning, sir, back in those days, I think that I was probably the first case, and it was very difficult for the military to know how to react. As a result, however, they've done an incredible job taking care of troops these days. I do believe that there's a lot to still be learned, but that's a different mentality when you're in versus when you're out. So, but in order to prepare me for employment, to be honest with you, sir, I deployed to get that break, to get that those finances coming back into the home, where it was just leaving. It was like an open wound, if you will. There was nothing coming in. It was all pouring out.
Thank you.
Representative Leif, follow up?
Thank you. Great, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for educating us on this issue. I do have one question. So can you be discharged honorably and not have taken care of your mental health issues or your chemical dependency issues, like on a medical discharge? I just want to make sure that if we're doing this, that people who get out actually have dealt with their issues and not been discharged honorably through for a medical reason or something.
Mr. Mattis Castile.
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative, can't see your name, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
There's more open-mindedness towards mental health issues in the military. Now, we know that PTSD is an anxiety disorder, and it can be managed, and you can't continue to serve, to include on the line as an infantryman, for instance. There are more severe cases, of course, and when that does happen, the military process is a medical discharge, which is still an honorable discharge. There's been a lot more open-mindedness to looking at the potential behavior of individuals that might be outside of their character of service to see whether or not there is mental health issues in the background in order to provide leniency in the discharge level, making it an honorable in most cases. Individuals that do leave the military are sort of on their own to get those services that they need. They get a lot of prompting, of course. They get a lot of coaching. We have a lot of systems out there that try to catch them in the net. Minnesota is one of those few states where if you knock on one veteran service industry door, you've knocked on them all. So we try not to let them fall through the cracks. But if you do come back from active duty and nobody knows that you're back from active duty, that is a potential issue. And hopefully they do run into the intersection with the veteran service industry where we start putting them back into the system. But it is difficult if they just come back out. If they come back through the National Guard or through the reserves, there's more that they can do. They could put the individual on orders. They can get them the medical treatment that they need, the psychological treatment that they need, and then release them. And that's being done more and more these days. Leaders are waking up to what needs to happen to take care of troops.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so how does this bill take care of that piece, for example, that you may have someone who hasn't dealt with their issues being honorably discharged and then making them it more easily for them to get a license?
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative, I believe that this is more focused on employment. So, although the individual would be encouraged to continue to seek treatment, this is more about the individual having been deployed after having been involved in a criminal justice intersection and then coming back showing that their character service is still honorable, that they that the incident could have been an isolated incident. And I think that this is pushing towards that isolated incident, such as mine, for example. Mine was a completely isolated incident. Nobody knew that it was coming. Nobody saw it coming, and then it happened. And what do we do now? I've never had anything like that in the past, and I haven't had anything since then. So I think that this is more about how do we assist an individual to get back into an employment situation where their mental health will be impacted favorably.
Mr. Chair, if I can add...
Mr. Baker, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom. I want to add that PTSD does not automatically mean that you're going to have contact with the criminal justice system. It's a small percentage of our returning combat veterans that are having some mental health issues, that are having touches with the criminal justice system. And then that what this bill does is it ceases... The honorable discharge then ceases to be competent evidence of a for a job. So I think that addresses that. But what really this bill addresses is for those individuals that have a criminal record before they go in the military, or in Mr. Mata Castillo's case, they had some criminal activity and then they went on to serve honorably in Iraq and be decorated and then come back home and have an honorable discharge. But just the PTSD, there's a small percentage that are having contact with the criminal justice system. I think that answers your question.
Okay. Representative Lesh.
Thank you. I just want to do a follow-up on previously, and I'd never asked you, Mr. Mattis Castillo, did you leave as a first sergeant or a master sergeant?
Mr. Mattis Castillo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh. My last position was as a first sergeant of a rifle company. After coming back from Iraq, I moved over to a training post for 1 month, and I believe I was a master sergeant at that point.
Well, and I just,
Representative Lesh.
It was probably neither here nor there, but I had a first sergeant at training who had not quite the same similar situation as you, but excelled, did really well as a mentor and as a trainer of all the individuals down at Fort Benning when I was there. There's some questions that people may have as, you know, why is it that, and as a prosecutor, there's always the question, why would you treat people differently when you need to reintegrate them into society? There's the basis that, you know, everyone gets treated the same under the law, regardless of what your job is. But the fact is, I would certainly hope that our veterans get treated differently, that our soldiers get treated differently. I know that there has got to be something different about you in the first place, I think, when you sign up. The things that were said about me, I know I heard about secondhand when I signed up. Something got to be wrong with that guy. And, you know, why would you do that to your daughter? You have an 8-year-old daughter. Why would you, you know, leave her for a period of time? Why would you go do that and potentially leave her without a dad? Well, it's I don't really know the answer to that, but I do know that if there's something wrong with me because of that, and it puts me in a position where I can be helpful and I can serve. I'm thankful for all the other guys, like First Sergeant Mattis Castillo, definitely, who put themselves in that situation. I would darn well hope that we treat them differently. I would like, to the extent that we can, we could do this, although there are definite constitutional problems with completely excluding the conviction wholesale. I think we need to move in that direction because that's the only thing that would really help our soldiers and our veterans overall, is to make sure this is wiped clean. But based on court decisions right now, that's too difficult. So I just wanted to make that comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Representative Anderson, do you have a
Thank you,
follow-up?
Mr. Chair. Along with the situation of members of the military coming back from overseas with PTSD. I recall before going in the military back in 67, 68, members coming back from the Vietnam War, and the fact of the way they were treated and the way the things happened to them, they should have had just as much problems as our members coming back today. And they were not treated. They were not treated very well, and they were not acknowledged and looked upon. In fact, several of the members that I still know today for years did not even talk about the war because of the way we in the United States treated our members in the military. So there's a long growing history of what's happened to our military forces, and some of them have hidden a lot of their feelings inside of them. And this year, along with the fact that we are acknowledging the fact of their service and the fact that they've got a DD-214, which is an honorable discharge, the ability to get a license to be able to do work afterwards is a key component to treating these individuals who have suffered quite a bit for our country, and I appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just a couple of things. First, a comment. You know, I think one of the things that this brings up is that we need to be more cautious on the front end when we convict people to separate mental health issues from criminal issues, something that we do rather poorly. And probably in your case, it sounds like that might have made a difference in a lot of your life if that had been handled like a mental health issue instead of as a criminal issue. But the second thing, I just want to ask a question kind of following up on Representative Hillstrom's point. Can you assure us that this doesn't create any public safety issues? I think that's kind of, the Judiciary Committee. We're not the Veterans Committee here, and you know, can you tell us with, you know, that this doesn't create any additional public safety issue than we might have now with people getting licenses?
Mr. Baker.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. I don't think you can ever guarantee that a returning veteran is going to something's not going to happen. I just don't think that guarantee can be made. I don't know that you know, if the bill is really designed to protect public safety, I think there's other we've got other statutes to do that. Of course, if somebody is going to reoffend, and in this case, that would take away their presumption to be able to get a license in some form or fashion. I think the state licensing processes also recognize that fact too. I think the Department of Human Services looks pretty carefully at whether somebody has any type of criminal conviction, and this bill does not take away that licensing authority to still scrutinize that. So I think that with all the other protections, licensing protections, I think public safety is still safeguarded in this process, and I think that answers your question.
All right. Any further questions? Seeing none, gentlemen, thank you for your testimony this morning. Thank you to all the men and women who have served our nation so faithfully. On behalf of this committee, we wish you a good day. There being no further discussion, the chair lays over House File 1124 as amended for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action at a later time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. The chair would now like to bring House File 229, Representative Downey, before the committee. Do I have a motion to move House File 229? So Representative Kreisel moves House File 229 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee. Good morning, Representative Downey. I understand you have an author's amendment.
I do, Mr. Chair. The A3 should be in members' packets. Okay. So it would be great if we
the chair moves
that.
The A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair now recognizes Representative Downey to explain House File 229 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members, you will perhaps remember if you were here that day, we presented this bill earlier in the session, and after some testimony from the county attorneys, decided it best to work out a little bit of extra language, which is what is now in the bill via the A3 amendment. So I feel like we've addressed any, I don't even know if they were concerns, but just clarifications that the county attorneys wanted in the bill. Let me just give a brief description of the history for those who weren't here and would be glad to answer questions. I'm not sure if there are testifiers as well. I have a constituent family in my district who had a young child, an elementary school girl, who was abused by their neighbor, immediate neighbor, and as part of the plea bargaining, really was most interested in gaining separation, getting their victim daughter some separation from the offender as part of the agreement in their plea bargaining, and in almost flat-out terms was told, you know, that wasn't possible or it wasn't really an option in the court of jurisdiction that they were in. Come to find out after the child was released after his summer-long rehabilitation program and planted right next door to their house, come to find out they realized that they could have fought harder for that provision, just were not aware that it was even a possibility. So this language here attempts to put clearly in statute the possibility of a, it's a permissive language, it's not mandatory, but permissive, that as part of the plea bargaining process, as part of the court's adjudication, that the offender could be placed more than 1,000 feet or three city blocks away from the victim upon return to their living situation. And so this bill now puts that language into statute across the first through fifth degree criminal sexual conduct sections of statute, as well as the criminal sexual predatory conduct section as well, so it's entirely consistent. The agreement that we worked out with the county attorneys is that we would put an age limit restriction on this of 15. The individual, the offender, would have to be over 15 years of age and not residing in the same home as the victim, so to avoid the familial issues. But assuming that those kinds of circumstances were met as part of the process, this residency requirement or this distance requirement could be imposed as part of the punishment. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Downey. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, I think the last time you were here, when we talked about this, the conversation came up that the judges already have the authority to do this. Is that correct? The judge already can do this, and you just want to put it into clarify that it's also in statute? Or how would you explain what your point is in bringing this bill?
Representative Downey.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, you are remembering correctly. What I learned through this whole process, and unfortunately what my constituents kind of fell victim to, was that practices vary greatly depending on the jurisdiction and the court that they're in. And it appeared that there was perhaps a practice in the court of jurisdiction that they were in that these kinds of things wouldn't be considered. In fact, it was relayed to them pretty explicitly that this was not an option, and frankly, this was really all they wanted as they were going through the plea bargaining process. And so the fact that we would put it into law would simply make it very clear across all of these degrees of criminal sexual conduct that this is a possibility as part of the adjudication of the sentencing.
And Representative Johnson. It's
possible to the county attorneys, did they sign on to this bill now then?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson. I certainly don't want to speak for them, but we did work with them and confirmed with them that they were okay with the amendment, and I spoke with them before the committee. If somebody wants to hear officially from them, I'd defer to them, but I believe they are okay with the language, and this is the comfort clarifications that they were interested in.
Representative Johnson.
Well, I suspect there's someone here from the county attorneys representing them, and if they want to speak up, they can. But with that, I'll end my questioning.
All right. Is there anyone here from the County Attorney Association that would like to speak to that question? Good morning and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your response.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nancy Haas with Messerly & Kramer, here today on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. We have reviewed the amendment, and consistent with Representative Downey's comments, he did address the concerns we raised at an earlier committee hearing, and so we are okay with this language.
Thank you, Ms. Haas. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and also to the County Attorneys Association, if I might. If currently under law you can get this restriction by a judge in any of these crimes, not just the ones that are listed, don't you believe that this is actually restricting the number of times when a judge can do this, because you're specifically only naming two statutes now, so you eliminate a judge's ability to do it in other criminal sexual conduct cases except these two that are listed?
So, Ms. Haas?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, actually with the amendment we're broadening it to first through fifth and also criminal sexual predatory conduct. And given that this is permissive and we view it's a guide, no, we don't think it's restrictive in other situations.
Okay.
Representative Hillstrom?
Nothing.
No further questions? Thank you, Ms. Haas. Seeing no further, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Downey, I think we had this discussion before, but my concern is still there, and that is, you know, when you can already do something in law, it seems to me that what you're doing here is just putting using our statute books just to put a signpost out there. Basically, I wonder if every time some prosecutor or judge misunderstands what's available to them, if we're going to then put it in the statute book specifically. I think that's kind of troubling. But a question that I have for you is, where did you get this 1,000 feet or three city blocks? Is that based on some research, or is that just arbitrary?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, I might defer to staff. I believe the 1,000 feet and three city blocks exists in other areas, and I can't remember exactly where, but I believe it's with drug offenders and proximity to schools, or there may be some proximity to schools language in other areas of statute. If staff could answer, that would be great.
Thank you. Mr. Diebel, would you have an answer for us?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not familiar with it being in statute, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's not in. But it has been used in bills before with regard to residency restrictions on sex offenders in proximity to schools and daycare centers. So it's very similar to what's been considered before in the legislature.
Great. Thank you for that information. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then Representative Downey, I don't see anything here that would prevent the child from going within that range if a judge was to order it. I think judges can order that now, and maybe you want to address that. But also, this 15 years of age, which I know you just explained wasn't something you pulled out of a hat, but nevertheless, I think it was kind of pulled out of a hat, and I'd sort of like to understand where that figure comes from. Why 15 years of age? I mean, if the offender is 14, the victim is going to be just as offended to see them next door as if they were 15. So frankly, you know, I guess I'd like to hear the answer to that, but, you know, I think that drawing these sort of artificial lines just to tell judges that they can do something that they can already do more broadly than this, I think it's a problem, not a solution. But maybe you'd like to address those couple of points.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. To the specific point of 15 years of age, originally the bill drafted did not have the age restriction, and that was one of the pieces of comfort language that the county attorneys wanted. So I guess I would defer to them for the rationale there in terms of how it maybe fits with other sentencing guidelines or kind of the generalized concept of rehabilitation versus punishment in these areas. I'm largely deferring to their wisdom on this as compared to my own. I probably would have preferred to leave it without the age restriction, but they were more comfortable with it in there. With regard to the broader point of are we just putting something into statute, I'll make a couple of strong statements. I was really surprised when I first got involved in this and began talking to the victim rights organizations and came to realize that, at least from my perspective, just as somebody who is envisioning themselves as, you know, the father of somebody who might have been abused and relating to the circumstances of my constituent, how everything seemed to be oriented towards the rehabilitation of the offender and the rights of the offender, and not the rights of the victim. And here's a case where, very clearly, somebody who, in their own plea bargaining process, explicitly wanted this kind of a solution for themselves, probably over and against everything else. And whether it was the practice of the court or, you know, caseload or other, you know, kind of logistical constraints, in essence, did not have that option available to themselves through the system. And so pointing this out in statute, in my mind, makes a lot of sense and at least maybe starts to tip the scales back towards victims' rights as compared to offenders' rights and a bias towards rehabilitation of the offender as compared to the protection of the victim.
Is there a follow-up, Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Downey, I don't disagree with you as far as the you know, the need to be looking at the impact on the victim. I think we certainly do need to look at impacts on victims, but frankly, I don't think that this really helps with that. And I think it's troubling. You know, I appreciate that you want to help your constituent, but too often around here, we put in legislation based on one incident, and we want to fix some particular situation. Now, it sounds to me like this was a training issue, maybe, for, I forget whether you said it was the judge or the prosecutor, or who exactly said they didn't have the authority to do this, but, you know, the fact that somebody can be wrong, or that somebody doesn't fully appreciate a situation, you know, I just don't think we can go and fix everything by filing a bill. Just because we can doesn't mean we should. I view it as a kind of micromanagement of the court system, and I just, you know, while I, you know, we can share the same concern over the particular situation that happened, and I think you're right to be concerned about that, I think this is a bad kind of a solution for that.
Representative Downey.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I'd say in general, I am totally in agreement with you. We far too often exercise our ability to legislate where we should just leave things alone. In this particular case, if this were in my mind, in my understanding of the incident and the practices of the courts, if this were simply a one-off mistake, I wouldn't be here proposing this to you. This appeared to be far more systemic than that, and a matter of practice. And again, I don't know what the constraints are or what it was that conspired in this situation and presumably others to not even have this discussion or to not even have the victim's family know that this was an option available to them. But absent that being readily available and out in front of victims' families, my sense is that the scales are tipped against the victims' families. And while this might seem like a bit of a strong measure, myself included, when I first thought about it, I think it's an appropriate measure and does just properly balance the scales for the victim.
Representative Downey. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out, in light of Representative Liebling's comments, that a lot is available to judges in district court, and as those of us who practice in district court are familiar with, everything is legal there until the Court of Appeals says otherwise. And there are many district court judges that play that to the hilt, are very well aware of it. Instead of saying, sue me, they say, appeal me, prove it otherwise, and they don't care what the law says in some instances. However, those signposts, I think, are worthwhile, and these statute books up here behind the committee table are full of signposts that remind judges of the things that they can do that they wouldn't otherwise do. I think of the civil gang injunctions we did a couple years ago in this body that are that were generally available in district court under nuisance statutes, but which judges weren't using. And so what we did is we put in place that signpost saying you could actually do this, and we've been successful in St. Paul in doing that, and other jurisdictions are looking at it as well. So that's why I think it's worthwhile. And as a person who works with victims, yeah, I can see how this would be another restrictive thing that gets put in place. However, Representative Downey, you're well aware of my concerns over sex offenders and in my community, the concentration of them, be they juvenile or otherwise. So I just wanted to point that out, that I think in certain instances, signposts can be worthwhile.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
No reply. Is there anyone else wishing to testify? Oh, pardon me. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one last question. So in the event that the judge orders this, who, if the parents choose not to move, the parents of the perpetrator choose not to move, and they don't have any place else for the child to, anyone else for the child to live with, who pays for them to live somewhere else? Will that be a county expense, or who will be responsible for those financial obligations?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I should probably defer to staff. I don't have professional expertise in this area. We did get a fiscal note with zero cost, so I think the presumption is that the offender and their family would bear the burden of this, but perhaps somebody who knows more about how these things are disposed of could answer. There's a zero fiscal note on it, so the presumption is that there isn't an additional cost.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. That means there's no state cost. That doesn't mean there's no county cost, I believe. But
Representative Downey,
Mr.
would you
Chair,
like advice from
if staff could maybe help answer, that would be great.
Okay. Mr. Diebel, would you weigh in on this issue?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't have any specific experience with this issue of out-of-home placements. It's more of a social work type issue. And so I suspect, though, if he didn't have a home, that the county would have to pay for his placement.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Ms. Adrian, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I, just like Mr. Diebel, I don't have experience, but the fiscal note does say zero, and it does say zero fiscal impact for local costs. So I think Representative Downey is right that the assumption is that the cost burden would be on the family at this point.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Adrian. All right. Is there anyone else wishing to testify for or against House File 229 as amended? If so, please come forward. There being no further witnesses, public testimony is now closed. Any further discussion on House File 229 as amended? Hearing no further discussion, Representative, who did we have make that motion? Representative Creasel renews the motion that House File 229 as amended be recommended to pass, re-referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion does prevail. House File 229 as amended is recommended to pass and re-referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome, Representative Downey. The chair will now bring House File 56 before the committee with the intention to lay the bill over. We have a motion to move House File 56.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson moves House File 56 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Civil Law Committee. The chair now recognizes Representative Dill to explain House File 56.
Thank you very much, Chair Szymanski and members. This is a bill about a problem that is ongoing in the state of Minnesota and other states that have sovereign immunity. And actually what I'm going to do is I have with me Major Breaker, Marty Breaker, and he will explain how he arrived at this situation. I'll tell you that since this occurred, Mr. Breaker has decided to go to law school after having a quite significant education. And now at age 60, he is going to graduate next week from law school, and he will begin, as I understand it, practicing ERISA law in Minnesota, in my district. Also, Mr. Breaker is an opponent of mine in two elections, in 2004 and 2008, and we have been good friends for many, many years, and we had probably the most polite campaign, of which in the 2008 campaign, I do not believe that either of us spoke each other's names, particularly in any kind of a bad way or in a critical way. So, Mr. Breaker is from Ely, and he can explain how we got here today.
Good morning, Mr. Breaker. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Martin Breaker, and David is not a military member, so I'm not a major, I'm a colonel. So, but anyways, Mr. Baker sat in this chair a little while ago and testified to you that about 15% of returning Minnesota veterans from the Iraq-Afghanistan conflicts are unemployed, and I'm one of those people that are unemployed. But the reason I'm unemployed is because Bemidji State University would not give me my job back when I returned from Iraq. I was a professor for Bemidji State University for over 8 years and received orders to Iraq in September 2005. I spent 3 years in Iraq, and as a colonel, I was one of the highest-ranking personnel in the country there and was given some very significant duties to perform, including I took care of Saddam Hussein and his henchmen for his trials, and following the trials, I was made commander of infamous Abu Ghraib, where all the horrible tortures occurred, and I was handpicked to make sure that nothing like that ever happened again. It did not. I closed that facility down and opened up a new detention facility where I was commander of that facility for 2 more years. I also received the Bronze Star like the first sergeant did and many other awards from my service in Iraq. But when I came back in 2008, like I said, Bemidji State refused to give me my job back or any job at all. Come to find out, though, I had no remedy in the court systems, either in federal court or state court, because the state of Minnesota sovereign immunity prevents me from suing the state as an individual. And so that's why we're here today, is this bill will give state employees the same rights as private individuals and federal government employees to sue to get their jobs back following their service. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Breaker. And Representative Dill?
Mr. Chairman, the Veterans Administration is also here, and they are very supportive of this bill. And Mr. Breaker is stating his case rather mildly. After pestering the university for quite some time to try and get a job, they made an attempt to give a job at a 29% pay decrease, relocate to another community many miles away. And he did bring suit, and the court filed their brief as a sovereign immunity, and so immediately he dropped the case because he was the proceedings couldn't go further. He had no grounds. And so maybe the Veterans Administration can talk about this.
Great. Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike McElhenney. I'm from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and I work in their legislative office. We just publicly want to state today that we support this bill. We think it's a good measure for our veterans. It moves in the direction that we would like to see the department and the state go as far as supporting our veterans. It's right in line with our mission statement. This is one more measure to provide stability for our veterans when they come back. As we looked at this USERRA measure, there are other states that implement this in their state statutes, and we also see that there's not a lot of litigation that actually occurs from this measure. It's relatively low. It won't cost the state anything as far as the department goes to implement this, and any relief that is provided is going to be relatively low, essentially just getting your job back for going forth and doing your duties when called to do so. So as we look at veterans that may work for Target or Best Buy or these other private areas as the local units, as Representative Dill mentioned, they have the ability to bring a suit where employees of the state do not, and we just wanted to express our support for this bill.
Okay. Sure. Are there any questions or any other Representative Lesh?
Thank you. Mr. Breaker, when I leave the St. Paul City Attorney's Office, for example, which is under city charter, but it's a creature of state statute, I leave for military service and I fill out a form saying, the date I'm leaving, my orders begin, and then the date that I'm getting back, although that can be a crapshoot sometimes. And they work with me pretty well on that. I haven't researched the statutes labeled in the form or anything, but what current protections are there for you? If you can't sue, I was maybe under some different impressions. I know that as a legislator, I sign a similar kind of form for a leave up here to come up here during my time when I'm not at the city attorney's office, and I researched that heavily before I ran for office, they're pretty solid protections, whereas for some of my colleagues here in private business, it's a lot tougher. If you want your job back when you're done, you might be SOL. Now, as far as military, what kind of protections do you currently have that you can't avail yourself of? Are there any?
Mr. Breaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Statute 190.055 does give some protections for National Guard officers in the state or state employees. But you have to be under state active duty orders or state orders in order to prevail yourself of USERRA protections. It does not include people who are activated under Title 10, which you may be familiar with. Title 10 activations are excluded from that protection. The 192.261 statute in Minnesota does provide for reinstatement for certain individuals, but it does not comport with current USERRA law. It was last amended many, many years ago to comport with the Vietnam Reemployment Rights Act, and there's many differences between that law and the current USERRA law. For example, that there's no protections for the discrimination portion of USERRA in any Minnesota statute that I've been able to find.
Okay.
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Breaker, when National Guard troops are activated, say, for deployment, they're activated under Title 10, as you know. So if you're on Title 10 orders for that period of time as a National Guard member in Minnesota, are you in the same quandary? Is that soldier in the same quandary as you were?
If they're a state employee, they are. It just applies to state employees that don't have the right to sue in court to get their job back because of the state sovereign immunity right. There's been 7 federal district courts that have ruled pursuant to a case called Seminole Tribe versus the state of Florida that you have no right in federal court to sue. And there's been several states that have determined from another Supreme Court case called Alden v. Maine that individuals do not have a right to sue in state courts as well. And this is specifically for USERRA rights. They bar these suits from both federal and state courts based on that 11th Amendment sovereign immunity rights of the state.
Okay. Representative Lesh.
No, thank you.
No further questions. Are there any other members of the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Is there any further discussion? Seeing no further public testimony is now closed. Is there any other discussion among the committee? Hearing no further discussion, House File 56 is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or for further action at a later time. Thank you, Representative Dale, and thank you, gentlemen, for your service to our country. All right. The chair would now like to bring House File 1370 by Representative Paymar before the committee. Do I have a motion to move House File 1370? Representative Johnson moves House File 1370 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Public Safety, Crime Prevention, Policy, and Finance Committee. The chair now recognizes Representative Paymar to explain House File 1370.
Mr. Chair, can I hear the motion again? What was it?
Mr. Chair, or Mr. Paymar, Representative Paymar. The motion will be that it be recommended to pass, re-referred to Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee.
And Mr. Chair, does then go to civil law, or I don't understand that?
Very likely. Mr. Representative Paymar, please introduce your bill.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. I'm just going to briefly explain the bill and then turn it over to my testifiers, but last year, in this state, 26 women were killed in domestic violence cases. Many of these women were fleeing abusive relationships. And as some of you who were around here a few years ago know, the state legislature funded what's called the Blueprint for Safety. And the Blueprint for Safety is a project that involves the city of St. Paul and Ramsey County, and the idea is to take multiple sources of risk analysis and try to define those offenders who pose the most risk to committing further acts of domestic assault and domestic homicides. One of the pieces that's missing in our efforts is allowing probation officers access to information that law enforcement has relative to pretrial hearings, sentencing, or supervision decisions. And so, members, what this bill does is that on Section 1 of the bill, it provides access
two probation officers to not public data from law enforcement. This does not change the classification. And then in Section 2 of the bill, it allows for the creation of what's called a domestic violence history summary. And I'm going to let my testifiers explain this. So with me today, I have Ellen Pence from Praxis International, who's worked as a consultant with the city and the county, Tara Patette with the city attorney's office. I have Phil Carruthers with the county attorney's office, a commander from the police department, someone from probation. So I think we should have all the bases covered, Mr. Chair. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Pence to explain that. To Tara Patette from the city attorney's office.
All right. Thank you, Representative Paymar. And Ms. Patette, please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tara Patette. I've been a prosecutor for the city of St. Paul for the past 16 years. Much of that time has been in the area of domestic violence. As you know, the city of St. Paul has been working very hard to implement the Blueprint for Safety, which is a comprehensive and collaborative approach to combating domestic violence in our community. One of the main principles that the Blueprint teaches us is that if we look at each act of domestic violence in context, we can better assess the risk that a particular offender poses to victims and to the public. But in trying to gather the information necessary to do that, to make that assessment, we as criminal justice practitioners have encountered two main roadblocks. One is that key partners in the criminal justice system are not able to share all of the necessary information with each other. These amendments would allow probation, police, and prosecution to share pertinent information. A second roadblock is that while much of the information we need to assess risk can be found in various databases currently, it is not summarized anywhere with regard to specifics, such as the type of violence that an offender has used and to whom his violence has been directed. So when an individual is arrested on a new offense, we are not able to connect all those dots in the very short period of time that we have between an arrest and a decision that we need to make on charging and pretrial release. It's important to note that these bills do not mandate the release of any information. Law enforcement retains its discretion to disclose information, and it does not change the current classification of any data. It simply allows us to have available critical information so that we can more appropriately and accurately respond to domestic violence when it occurs. Thank you for your consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Patette.
My name is Ellen Pence. I was responsible for meeting with all of the agencies to put together this Blueprint for Safety, which there is a Minnesota version and a St. Paul version, and I just want you all to know that the whole country thanks you. The Department of Justice just put out a solicitation to fund 7 sites around the country to replicate the Minnesota Blueprint. New Orleans got it, Memphis got it, several other sites got it. So. It's actually become the kind of this gold standard for responding to domestic assault cases around the country now. When we were doing this project, my job was to go and sit at the 911 center and ask people, what do you need to do your job right? Then ride along with the officers and say, what do you need to do your job right? And they all wanted more information than they had, and they wanted it now. They didn't want it. They needed it right now. While we were doing the blueprint, I think some of you might remember an officer, Crichton, who was killed when he was helping a woman get into her house after a protection order. There was a North St. Paul officer who was shot in the head by this guy. And in the next 2 days, the media came out with all this information about this guy. He had done this, and he had done this, and there were these protection orders, and there were different women, there were different this. And I remember thinking, how come the media can pull all this together in 2 days after someone's dead, and we can't do it before someone's dead, right there at the bail setting hearing, right there when the officers are going out? Why didn't he have access to that picture? And so that's what we started to say. We need a summary, and where did we find that it was already being written was with the pre-sentence investigation. The probation officer was already gathering all that, putting that picture together, but for one purpose, for a judge to sentence on one case, and then that just got hidden in this document called the pre-sentence investigation, and that information didn't get out to people. So the whole purpose of the blueprint is to respond. Domestic violence is, you know, most people in their relationships shove, push, or hit their partners. Most people in this room, half of us have done it. That doesn't make us wife beaters, or it doesn't make us husband beaters. What makes a person a wife beater or husband beater is someone who does a sustained effort of intimidation, coercion, and violence. Those are the people we're trying to figure out who's doing that, not who pushed someone, but who's doing that. And we can't figure that out unless we gather the information, unless we share it with each other. So when a judge is doing a bail setting hearing, they know not just what happened that night before, but the context of it. And this is going to allow us to get the right information to the right people at the right time. And it's crucial for the implementation of this incredible document that St. Paul's put together.
Representative Paymar.
If there's time, I'd like to, there's a commander from the St. Paul Police Department that would like to provide some brief testimony. And
all right. Please step forward to the witness table and introduce yourself, sir, and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Axel Henry. I'm the commander of the Family and Sexual Violence Unit for the City of St. Paul Police Department. Thank you, Mr. Chair and the Board. Just a couple of points I just want to add on to what was already been said so well. I don't want to belabor any of that. What we're looking to do is certainly shouldn't be looked at as an effort to unlock the file cabinet, open it up, and let people just rummage through it. We're not looking to have that information available haphazardly. It'd be very controlled. It would be on a case-by-case basis, very specific to the crimes that we're investigating. But it's important, like Mrs. Pence said, is that unlike other crimes, for example, a burglary or maybe your car gets stolen, these are crimes that involve people that are in relationships with one another. So the context of that relationship often is over years and years of time. And the only way to accurately interpret what's going on in that situation is to have a view of that context, not the specific crime that we're maybe investigating that night or that incident. It needs to be a contextual overview of that. And we need to have that ability when it's important to be able to advise probation and other groups about information that we have that allows us to share that in a timely fashion so that the public is safer and so that the victims in these specific crimes are safer.
Thank you, Officer Henry.
Mr. Chair, we have
Representative Paymar
from the Ramsey County Probation.
Okay. Good morning. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm John Menke. I'm Assistant Director of Adult Field Services with Ramsey County Community Corrections Department. This has been a long collaboration. The idea behind this bill, in that we're creating a new document with a variety of information in it, is to both provide for the sharing of that document as specified and to restrict the further dissemination of it to protect victims. Thank you very much.
And then, Mr. Chair, just briefly,
Representative Paymar.
Well, we have Phil Carruthers here in case you have any questions, also with the Ramsey County Attorney's Office.
All right. Thank you, Representative Paymar. Is there anyone else in the room today? First of all, are there any questions of the testifiers among the committee? Okay, seeing none, is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay, I bring no further witnesses. Public testimony is now closed. Is there any further discussion on House File 1370? Representative Paymar, if there's no further discussions, do you have a final comment before we proceed?
No, except, Mr. Chair, when I was chairing this, it was much more controversial when bills came up. Thank you very much.
We maintain law and order here. So, hearing no further discussion, Representative Johnson renews the motion that House File 1370 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. House File 1370 is recommended to pass and be referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee. This time, we will bring, the chair would now bring House File number 201 by Representative Scott before the committee. As Representative Scott is not here at the moment, we will hold briefly until she arrives. All right. Okay. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think
Representative Hillstrom?
I think your bill is not that controversial. Maybe we could take up yours while we wait.
Representative Scott is here.
Oh, okay.
Good morning, Representative Scott. The chair would now bring House File 201 by Representative Scott before the committee. Do I have a motion to move House File 201? Representative Vogel moves House File 201 to be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. The chair now recognizes Representative Scott to explain House File 201.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and excuse my tardiness. I was across the hall. I have two bills up this morning, so I'm kind of dueling here. Nearly 32% of all abortions in 2009 were paid for by taxpayers, a total of $3,933, costing Minnesotans $1.5 and some change million dollars. Minnesota's Doe v. Gomez is the reason that since 1995, Minnesota taxpayers have paid for over $16.5 million, have paid over $16.5 million for elective abortions. Less than 1% of abortions are done in cases of rape, incest, or to save the life of the mother. This means that the vast majority of abortions are being performed as a backup means of birth control. Doe v. Gomez has given Minnesota the most liberal abortion laws in our country, and this bill does not address the right to an abortion. The bill would end the taxpayer funding of abortions by both pro-life and pro-choice citizens who polls show want this practice to end. What I'd like to do first is introduce Jordan Bauer with MCCL, and then she will be turning it over to our legal expert, Teresa Collette, to address the legal issues of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Ms. Bauer, please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jordan Marie Bauer, and I am here on behalf of Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, a grassroots organization with over 70,000 member families and over 240 chapters across the state. I urge you to pass House File 201. House File 201 would conform Minnesota's policy on abortion with the federal government by reinstating a ban on most taxpayer-funded abortions. You see, in 1978, Minnesota passed a law that prohibited taxpayer-funded abortions, except in the cases of reported rape, incest, and to save the mother's life, just like the federal government's Hyde Amendment. However, a lower court ruling in June of 1994 struck down that ban, and the Minnesota Supreme Court's 1995 Doe versus Gomez decision established a right to abortion in the Minnesota Constitution, as Roe versus Wade did on the federal level. However, the Gomez decision goes even further by requiring that Minnesota taxpayers be forced to pay for abortions, one of the nation's most extreme state policies regarding abortion. As a result, today nearly 32% of all abortions performed in Minnesota are paid for with taxpayer dollars. This amounts to about $1.5 million per year. And from the time of the court decisions until the end of 2009, taxpayers spent over $17 million on nearly 55,000 abortions. A March 2010 poll of Minnesota's 8th Congressional District found that 73% of registered voters oppose using tax dollars to pay for abortions. These results are consistent with other state and national polling data. So that means that Minnesota taxpayers, a strong majority who don't want government funds being used for abortion, have essentially helped end the lives of nearly 55,000 unborn children, and that's a number that continues to grow every single day. Now is the time for the legislature to represent the will of the people by passing a ban on taxpayer-funded abortions. And some may argue that this is discriminatory to not provide low-income women with a taxpayer-funded abortion. However, federal courts have disagreed with this notion. In fact, for decades, the federal government, with the approval of the courts, has forbidden most taxpayer-funded abortions, just as we seek to do here today. And this is not an issue of whether abortion should be legal or illegal, as this bill does not seek to outlaw abortion. It does, however, return the issue of whether or not the taxpayers of this state should be forced to fund a practice, which the majority oppose, to the policymakers of this state where their decision is rightly decided. Justice Coyne in the Doe versus Gomez dissent points out, quote, "The majority spurns this court's own advice to the legislature that this important political issue, the funding of abortions, should be decided by the legislature where everyone can have his say." There are a number of valid points made in the dissent opinion in the Doe versus Gomez case. For example, Justice Coyne, writing for the minority, points out that while the majority in Doe suggests that the right at issue in Gomez is the same as what is addressed in Roe versus Wade, it is not the same right. And quote, that there is a very significant difference between a right to decide to terminate a pregnancy by abortion without fear of criminal complicity and a right to compel the state to pay for the abortion, end quote. Furthermore, as Justice Coyne points out, while Roe versus Wade maintains neutrality on whether abortion is moral or immoral, in the Doe versus Gomez case, quote, the majority promptly abandons all vestiges of neutrality. The majority frankly extols abortion as a positive good and the cure for all the ills from which a pregnant woman could possibly suffer, end quote. We agree with Justice Coyne and believe the state can do better for pregnant women. Rather than just giving them a tax-funded abortion, which the majority of Minnesotans are opposed to, the state would be better served to provide for them the resources and support that they truly need. A ban on taxpayer funding of abortion is a reasonable measure which should be supported by pro-life and pro-choice advocates alike. Unless we wish to force citizens to fund an act that they do not support, and to do it at a rate of more than 10 times every day, we should all be supporting this common sense legislation that protects and respects our fellow Minnesota citizens. I urge you to support House File 201 and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Bauer. And Ms. Collette, would you proceed with your testimony and please introduce yourself.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. My name is Teresa Collette. I'm a professor of law at the University of St. Thomas. In addition to that, I also currently serve as Special Attorney General for the state of Oklahoma, defending that state's ultrasound law related to abortion. I appear both as an academic and a practicing lawyer. However, the remarks I'm about to make do not in any way represent the state of Oklahoma, the University of St. Thomas, or any other organization or other individuals. I've been asked to address whether or not this particular legislation is something that should be passed. In fact, the bill is very simple. It prohibits the use of taxpayer dollars for abortions except for the extent required by for participation in a federal program. Federal health care law currently limits the funding of abortion through taxpayer dollars to rape, incest, and threat to the mother's life. This is reinforced by President Obama's executive order related to the Health Care Affordable Protection Act. That particular funding requirement has been found constitutional by the United States Supreme Court in Harris versus McRae, in which the court said, although the liberty protected by the Due Process Clause affords protection against unwarranted government interference with freedom of choice in the context of certain personal decisions, it does not confer an entitlement to such funds as may be necessary to realize all of the advantages of that freedom. To hold otherwise would mark a drastic change in our understanding of the Constitution. In fact, in 1980, when Harris versus McRae was decided, it was also the law of the state of Minnesota. Minnesota, 11 days after the holding of Roe versus Wade, constitutionalized the question of abortion in deference to the federal Constitution. The Minnesota Supreme Court recognized in two opinions at that point that it was the federal constitution that conferred a right to obtain an abortion in the state of Minnesota. So from 1973 until 1995, the right to obtain an abortion was considered a federal constitutional right, not a state constitutional right. In 1973, the question of whether or not funding should be provided through state medical assistance was determined to be a matter of administrative decision. However, that particular position was disavowed by the court in McKee versus Lincolns, which had been referred to earlier in 1977. In that particular opinion of the Minnesota Supreme Court, the court admonished the administrative agency regarding its policy and said, an important political issue like public financing of abortion ought to ideally be decided by the legislature where everyone can have its say. That statement was not from the United States Supreme Court, but rather from the Minnesota Supreme Court. And such was the law from 1977 to 1995. In fact, there was limited funding in the state for abortions from that point forward by legislative act. And the state funded approximately 12 abortions a year, according to plaintiffs' counsel in Doe versus Gomez in their motion for summary judgment. 12 abortions a year, a dramatic difference from that which taxpayers are currently burdened with funding more than 50,000 abortions from the period of 1995 to the present. This particular legislation would restore the balance that the Minnesota Supreme Court found in McKee versus Lincoln's. It would allow the legislature to determine what the court characterized as an important public issue and relieve taxpayers of the obligation to fund a process which many Minnesotans find to be immoral and they believe should in fact not be the burden of taxpayers. This particular bill also minimizes the disruption in that should the question of whether it is constitutional under Doe versus Gomez, which I concede it clearly is not, but it resolves that issue in favor of the legislative decision rather than judicial decision making and facilitates judicial review of this immediately by Section 3, which brings it to the attention of the Minnesota Supreme Court. I urge this court to restore the balance between legislative and judicial powers and to, in fact, allow this body and the taxpayers of Minnesota to be relieved of the burden of paying for those abortions that are not necessary to preserve a woman's life or result from rape or incest. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Collette. We have questions from the committee. We also have other witnesses to testify for this bill. I would urge the committee members, against the bill as well. I would recommend or remind committee members and testifiers to keep your questions and answers brief and to the point so that we can proceed with this hearing. First, we have Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Scott or staff. I was wondering if you could explain to me what a state-sponsored health care program is.
Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moline, that would be like medical assistance, any one of the state-sponsored health care programs that we have in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, so is it the same as a state-funded health care program?
Representative Scott.
Okay, yes, it would be medical assistance or GAMC.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, so this wouldn't extend to state employees whose salaries and health care also come from taxpayer money?
Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moline, this would only apply to state-sponsored health care programs that the state funds.
So, Representative Scott, it wouldn't apply to state employees whose salary or health care comes from taxpayer money as well?
Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair, no.
Agree. Representative Lesch.
Thank you. My question is for Ms. Collette. Ms. Collette, I was reading something in the middle part of your testimony, and so I don't think I heard everything you said about another state. Something went from 50,000 to 12,000. What state was that? And was it the number of abortions or something? Sorry, if you remember, maybe you don't remember.
Ms. Collette.
Mr. Chairman, I believe Representative Lesch is referring to my testimony that prior to Doe versus Bolton, according to the plaintiffs, in Doe versus Gomez, according to the plaintiffs, the state funded 12 abortions per year in Minnesota. After 1995, with the rendition of Doe versus Gomez, we have now funded over 50,000 abortions from 1995 to the present.
Okay.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you. Then, Ms. Collette, is it your testimony then that after this law passes, that the need for abortions will be reduced in Minnesota?
Ms. Collette.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesch, I am uncertain what the need for abortion is. I think that's a disputed concept, and so if the representative could refine his question, I would appreciate it.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the need was 12 prior to Doe versus Gomez, and the need is 50,000 afterwards, I'm wondering if for those people that had a need for an abortion, due to whatever circumstance, if you expect that that need would be reduced by 49,988 abortions.
Ms. Collette.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, by the use of the phrase need, you're suggesting that this is a medically required procedure. It is not like an appendectomy or some other procedure that's necessary to sustain health. In fact, the position that I take is that prior to Doe versus Gomez, the state funded abortions consistent with the Hyde Amendment, those that pregnancies that resulted from rape and incest or where the abortion was necessary to preserve the life of the mother. At that time, we found that we funded only 12 per year, again, according to the plaintiffs in Doe versus Gomez. If that statistic holds steady, notwithstanding the population increase, I certainly would expect to see a dramatic decrease in the number of publicly funded abortions.
Representative Lesh.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Collette, the reason I'm asking is because currently it's legal. As far as I can tell, everything, I mean, abortion is legal. So my question then does relate to need, because if people feel they have a need for an abortion, they currently have a legal right under the Constitution of the United States and Minnesota to get an abortion. So my impression by your statistics is that you would think that that would be reduced. Is that an incorrect assumption on my part, Ms. Collette?
Ms. Collette.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, from the period of 1973 to the period of 1995, abortion was legal in the state as a matter of federal constitutional right, and yet the state funded only 12 per year, again, according to the plaintiffs in Doe versus Gomez. If we restore the prohibition of state funding outside of the circumstances of incest, rape, and life of the mother, I would expect to see a dramatic reduction in the amount of abortions that the state pays for.
Okay.
Representative Lesh.
So then, just to be clear, you're not suggesting that there would really be any reduction in the number of abortions in Minnesota if we were to pass this law. Is that correct?
Ms. Collette.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, in fact, there is evidence from other states that an elimination of state funding of abortion does reduce the number of abortions. However, that is not the position I'm taking before this committee. I am happy, however, to provide the representatives and members of this committee copies of those studies.
Okay, Mr.
Representative Lesh, we do have another testifier.
This will be my last question for her, Mr. Chair, if that's all right. Thank you. Ms. Collette, then, if you could just say how much you think it would be reduced in Minnesota based on the evidence you have from other states.
Ms. Collette.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, it has varied from state to state. I'm not prepared to give you a calculation at this time, but again, if the chairman will permit me, I'm happy to provide supplemental testimony and calculate that for you.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Are we laying this bill over, or are we voting on this today?
Okay. Representative Lesh, if we do not finish testimony this morning, we will come back later this afternoon and pick up this bill and the remainder of the agenda.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and vote on it or lay it over for
inclusion. We will be voting on this.
Okay,
bill.
Thank you. Well, then, thank you, but I need the I'd probably need the numbers then today, Ms. Collette.
Ms. Collette?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, if in fact we reconvene at 4:30, I'll have them for you.
Okay, thank you. And then lastly, Mr.
Lesh.
Chair, by way of closing comment, you know, there are a lot of things that I'd rather not fund with my tax dollars. I think about Representative Cornish's legislative salary, for example. That'd be great. I just don't want to fund that.
Representative Lesh, let's keep personalities out of this discussion.
But you know, I mean, there are laws we have to come together and vote for. So anyway, that's my point.
All right. Thank you, ladies. The next testifier to come before this committee. Okay. We do have another testifier, Charles Samuelson. Please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Charles Samuelson, and I'm the Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota. We are funded and supported by over 8,500 members in Minnesota. The ACLU of Minnesota opposes House File 2001 because it is a direct challenge to the Minnesota constitutional right to privacy. In Doe v. Gomez, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that, quote, our Constitution protects not simply the right to an abortion, but rather it protects the women's decision to abort. any legislation infringing on the decision-making process, then, violates this fundamental right. We simply cannot say that an indigent woman's decision whether to terminate her pregnancy is not significantly impacted by the state's offer of comprehensive medical services if the woman carries the pregnancy to term. We conclude, therefore, that these statutes constitute an infringement on the fundamental right of privacy. Proponents of House File 2001 are banking on the hope of the Minnesota Supreme Court reversing this decision. The legal standard for the Minnesota Supreme Court to reverse itself is this, quote, where the reasons underlying a particular rule have ceased to exist, or where the rule no longer conforms to the changed condition of society, we do not blindly adhere to the former decisions, even though legally sound when the case was decided. Doe v. Gomez was decided on December 15, 1995, 15 and a half years ago, less than one generation. Two Supreme Court justices who voted in favor of the Doe v. Gomez decision continue to sit on the Minnesota Supreme Court. The underlying principles articulated in 1995 were, one, the Minnesota Constitution contains a right to privacy which includes every woman's fundamental right to decide to terminate her pregnancy free from unwarranted government intrusion. And two, by funding childbirth-related health services, the state uses financial incentives to insert itself into a woman's decision-making process. Therefore, if this committee adopts House File 2001, it must be making a finding of a changed condition of society on one of these two points. The government now has the power to overrule a woman's decision to terminate a pregnancy, or the state no longer funds childbirth-related health services. A third finding could possibly be that women on public assistance need the government to make medical decisions for them. We challenge the proponents of House File 2001 to produce evidence of such a change in society in 15 years that support any of these points. Because short of making factual findings on either of these two points, the legislature will be asking the Minnesota Supreme Court to make a political decision, not a legal decision, about state funding of abortion. The Minnesota Supreme Court has held since 1934 that if the question is political rather than legal, the courts will have nothing to do with it in any event. The case is Rockne v. Olson. Therefore, because we are unaware of any change in society so material that the Supreme Court must overturn its earlier decision, we oppose House File 2001.
Thank you, Mr. Samuelson. Is there anyone else wishing to testify for the House File, for or against House File 201?
Yes.
Welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. I'm Reverend T. Michael Rock, clergy person at Robbinsdale United Church of Christ and professor of Christian ethics at United Theological Seminary. It's a pleasure to be here today and to oppose this legislation. As a member of the United Church of Christ, we are proudly put on our publicity that we're the first denomination to ordain women. Antoinette Brown was a gifted preacher and teacher back in the 1830s, and she taught us a lot about remembering that Jesus showed respect and trust to women and to the poor. And our denomination is built upon understanding the commitments to women and the poor. And I believe this legislation completely opposes the respect and trust of women and the poor. And there's a lot to say about respect and trust in this moment, and I could try to convince folks theologically with all kinds of eloquent examples about why you should agree with me, but I know this contentious issue will not change minds and hearts. And so it's important, I think, just to kind of pause for a second and reflect on these poignant words. It's a poem called No Small Thing. Knit together my mother's womb, was I disconnected? A floating bag of limbs, organs, and bones? How does this happen? I love being known, being made, fearfully and wonderfully made. I love my God who searches for me, heals me, and does not allow me to hide. Life is a gift. Life is communion. Life is inspiration. Life is love. God and me, me and God. A holy dance through trial, trouble, and temptation. The source of that dance, the beginning of that dance, the hands, the eyes, the body, the choice. This is the honoring of all life. This is the place that God allows us to choose. Is this my dance? Is this the right time, the right place to create something new? It's always the woman, the mother, the source of life. She is holy. She is honored. She chooses life or not. God holds her, prepares her, and loves her choice. They are not separate. They cry together. They laugh together. They create together. The mother knows that God knows. The power of creation is no small thing. God knows, the mother knows, the power of creation is no small thing. Where do I come from? I come from the womb, created by God in the mother, in the beginning. I am chosen, I am alive. May our choice be protected by you.
Thank you. Mr. Rock, we have a question from Representative Cornish.
Yes.
I got to count to 10 before I give my question or comment. I find your testimony particularly disgusting. Invoke the Lord's word in support of abortion. And that bag of limbs and bones that you described could be found outside an abortion clinic in a sack of limbs and bones that have been just sucked out of a mother's womb. And I find the ACLU is just about as disgusting. Sometimes I question it. You attack people's liberties more than you defend them. In the cases I've seen this year. So this, I want to thank you, Representative Scott, for bringing this bill forward. I can't wait to vote for it, and I just unbelievable about invoking the Lord's word. I wouldn't do that in opposition to abortion. To bring the Lord's word into this and to, yeah. But anyway, that's all I got to say. I look forward to voting for your bill,
Representative Gruenhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Samuelson. You know, when I look at this, this current law, one of the reasons I support the current bill is because I oppose judicial fiat activism. In other words, the funding of abortion was not done through the legislative process by representatives of the people. It was simply declared to be so by judges. And I see that type of decision making and activism needs to be challenged by the legislative branch. In addition to that, when I look at additional scientific and medical information that's now available in the last 15 years in terms of the unborn child, and I think the court needs to take a second look at this, and in terms of the decision they made, and reevaluate it based on current scientific and medical facts compared to 1995. So any response to that in terms of the judicial fiat decision?
Mr. Samuelson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gruenhagen, the question of judicial activism, is not one that I can't really comment on, for the simple reason that it depends quite frequently on where you sit and how you agree with the underlying decision. This case, the Doe v. Gomez case, is not an abortion case. It's a privacy case. And if the government is willing to fund pregnancy to term, then the government, in the Doe v. Gomez case, is equally obligated to fund an indigent person's decision to terminate her pregnancy. That's the decision of the court. And in order to keep this bill from being unconstitutional, that's the decision that the court would have to overturn. It is the contention of the ACLU that we require an independent judiciary in order to balance off the political competing battles that occur, and in order to, frankly, provide rights to the minority that the majority, who by definition would be the winner of the political debates, would want to limit.
Thank you, Mr. Samuelson. We do notice that there is one more witness to testify. We are nearing the end of our committee time. Would you like to take the time now to provide your testimony, or would you prefer to come back later this afternoon? Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Linnea House, and I'm the Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota. My organization represents over 60,000 Minnesotans throughout the state, and our mission is to guarantee that every woman has the right to make personal decisions regarding the full range of reproductive rights and choices, including legal abortion, preventing unintended pregnancy, and bearing healthy children. I am here in opposition of House File 201. First, I believe that we can all agree that we want all women to be healthy and safe. Second, I also believe that we all want women to have the ability to make the best decision about when or if to have a family. Therefore, we must safeguard a woman's health and safety while protecting personal decision-making. Even if we disagree about abortion, a woman's health and safety should come first, regardless of how she receives her health insurance. Our families are too important to put them at risk, but denying insurance coverage based upon how someone gets their health insurance can do just that by putting a woman's health in jeopardy. In the real world, this political interference in medical and personal decision-making wouldn't end abortions, but could push them into later pregnancy. Many things happen in pregnancy that are beyond a woman's control, so it's important to make sure that every woman has coverage for the health that she may need. The decision to have an abortion can be a difficult, life-changing decision, not one that any woman undertakes without great consideration, and we don't need to make it any harder, not for any woman. But especially not for those disadvantaged women who are struggling to make ends meet from paycheck to paycheck, who are already facing great challenges. A woman facing an unintended pregnancy should not have to make the decision about whether or not to end her pregnancy based on whether she has enough money. It should be based on what is best for her health and for her family circumstances. If abortion coverage is available to some, it should be available to all. It's a matter of basic fairness. We shouldn't treat some women's health needs differently because others just because of the type of the insurance that they have. And even if we disagree with her decision, we shouldn't tell. The legislature should not tell any woman she has to remain pregnant. Finally, the decision to have an abortion is one that each woman needs to be able to make for herself. It's not a decision for those in the legislature to make for her. We shouldn't allow politicians to make medical decisions for someone based on how she receives her health insurance. This is a political interference in a woman and her family's private medical decisions. In Minnesota, we have a strong history of supporting pregnant women in making personal, private decisions, even if those are decisions we don't necessarily agree with. This bill would violate Minnesota's constitutionality guaranteed a right to privacy. This bill is using some of Minnesota's most vulnerable women to score political points. A woman enrolled in medical assistance is already feeling the consequences of our current economic crisis. The legislature's time and resources would be better spent supporting programs and health care measures that reduce unintended pregnancy. Again, I ask you to vote no on House File 201. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. We are out of committee time right now. Unless the committee would like to move to a vote now, we will recess until the call of the chair, approximately 4:30 this afternoon. Is there a request from members to vote?
I had a comment I wanted to make, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Liebling, is it a very brief comment?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Barnes.
I'm probably going to have a brief comment after her brief comment.
All right. The comments get too extensive. We will recess. So, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just had a couple things I wanted to respond to. And first of all, Representative Grunhagen had talked about judicial activism, and I think that was answered. But I just wanted to make that a little more clear, Representative Grunhagen. I think, what we call a judicial activist is a judge whose decision we disagree with. And I know you probably don't think that's true, but we can point to judicial activism all over the spectrum, and I think that's what Mr. Samuelson was referring to. But I just wanted to kind of bring more into focus why this is about the right to privacy. You know, there are some reasons that are given here that even if this bill were to pass, a woman could still get a funded abortion for certain reasons, right? Incest, rape, protecting her life. That requires somebody to determine that woman's reasons are the right reasons. And that means intrusion into the doctor-patient relationship. So a woman goes to a doctor, decides that for her own reasons she needs an abortion, whether it's for rape or incest or what. But it requires somebody else to get involved and say, is your reason good enough? And that is a problem. And I know, Representative Grunhagen, you and I agree, I think, that there should be no state intrusion into the relationship between a person and their physician. That should be a private relationship, and that, I think, is the privacy that's protected in the Minnesota Constitution. Secondly, just briefly to respond to Representative Cornish, and I don't know if you're going to need to respond, Representative Cornish, but I think the point of the testifier, you can disagree with him, and I know this raises a lot of very strong feelings on both sides, but I think the point here is just that there can be diversity of opinion on this within the religious community, that none of us owns a corner on what God's word is. We may believe we do, but this is about the state as a secular entity. And I think the point here is that we, out of our own religious beliefs, should not be imposing that on other people who may not share them. And if we, and sometimes in this abortion debate, that's what this becomes. And I agree, it isn't entirely, I'd like to keep religion out of all of this. And I think I heard you say that you do too, Representative Cornish. And I think that's a good thing. I think that's all this is about, that people of religious faith can be on both sides of this issue.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Cornish.
That was a lot less vicious than I thought it would, you know. Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to tell this story. I'm real slow here, so the last time I tried to tell it, I wasn't able to finish it. But when I was married, we tried to have kids for about 4 years, and we couldn't, and so we adopted. And the adopted son that I got came from a very young woman, special needs, and lived with her grandparents and didn't have dirt for money. And so thank God that she made the decision to have the baby, because she met the perfect classification for all the liberals in the world that think that women should abort their babies for financial reasons. It was particularly disgusting when that was brought up today to say that a mother can't afford a baby, it's okay to abort it. So at any rate, if I would like legislation that slows the process down, gives it closer scrutiny, because if somebody in the liberal world or the universalist Unitarian common church would have got a hold of her and gave her all these fancy reasons why she should abort, she probably could have, but thank God she got the right advice, and now I'm going on 10 grandchildren, and 5 of them come from that son that I adopted. And so it comes from a personal, from a religious, from all sorts of feelings mine about abortion, and to save the mother's life, I can hack that. But these other reasons you throw in there about financial distress and everything, everybody's had financial distress. I came from a family of 9 kids on a farm, very financially distressed. In fact, if you see a picture of the place now, they wouldn't let you have it in town. And the whole mother broke down and bawled when the doctor told her that she couldn't have a dozen babies, because she wanted to have a dozen babies. So anyway, long story short, I support your bill for personal, religious, and a whole bunch of reasons, and I'd like to take a vote before we adjourn.
All right. Brief comment. We have several committee members who would like to comment, but if we want to vote, we can vote this through the committee right now or continue later this afternoon. Is there a consensus to vote?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Okay. Hearing no further discussion. Who made the motion?
I did.
Oh, Representative Vogel renews the motion that House File 201 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay.
No.
The motion does prevail, and House File 201 is recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. This hearing is adjourned.